Hi, it's Patrick Caldwell here, and you're listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast.
Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Today we are having a conversation with a really good friend of mine, endodontist from Brisbane, Dr. Pat Caldwell. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
Mate, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show. And we're going to have a bit of fun today. I'm looking forward to diving into the conversation and unpacking a few things. But, mate, before we get into that, I just want to run through your bio for a little bit for those who are not from Brisbane and who may not know you. Mate, you did your Bachelor of Dental Science at the UQ, University of Queensland, and finished in 1998.
Yep.
And you became a Navy dentist for a while, and that's where we first met. And you did lots of really fun and interesting stuff there, which I'm super keen to hear about because I only heard the sanitized version through the Navy channels. So I'm looking forward to hearing what really happened with your career. It's going to be a lot of fun. And you then went and did an endodontic master's degree and completed that in 2005. So, mate, have I covered most of that pretty clearly?
Yeah, from a professional point of view, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, now for the unprofessional point of view. So, mate, you're a Brisbane boy.
That's right.
You grew up in Brizzy?
Yeah, I grew up in Logan City. So that was a sort of place that you tend to grow up in and leave as soon as you can, as soon as you have the ability to. I was born in New Zealand originally, and I was about 4 years old when I moved to Australia. So my father was Australian, mother was my mother was Australian, my father was a Kiwi, and we moved over here. And I was probably about 10 years old when my father seemed to switch allegiance from the All Blacks to the Wallabies, and I probably followed suit at about that age too.
Are you regretting that decision now?
Oh, well, I can switch back and forth as required.
Yeah. So, okay, that's a really interesting thought. So, do you consider yourself Kiwi or do you consider yourself Aussie or you're somewhere in the middle? You're stuck in the middle of the ditch.
Yeah, I probably, if I was being honest, I'd probably say I consider myself Australian. But I obviously have a lot of Kiwi relatives and I definitely identify in some aspects as a Kiwi. And quite clearly, if you couldn't be an Aussie, you'd be a Kiwi. So, probably got the best of both worlds there.
Yeah, actually really lucky. I reckon the Bledisloe Cup games must be a fantastic family time in your house, mate. You can't lose. And everyone's a winner. So, great. Have a bet each way.
That's it.
Yeah, beauty. So, mate, you went to school in Brizzy? Or did you go to school, you started your schooling in New Zealand? Or did you do all
that? No, did my schooling in Brisbane and Logan City.
Yep, okay. And so, when you were going through school, when did you first think about becoming a dentist? Had you always wanted to be a dentist? Or were you kind of thinking about that as you went through high school?
I didn't particularly want to be a dentist. I was thinking about being a doctor. For a while, my parents weren't particularly well off, and they worked pretty hard and sacrificed a fair bit to put me into a private school.
Yeah.
And that was all with the aim of getting a good education. And yeah, all I knew growing up was that I was going to get myself into university and then wake tables or wash dishes or whatever to put myself through university in order to get a decent job where that job had the same title as the degree that you did at university.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how I was brought up. I was interested in medicine, and then funny story actually, I had lost my mouth guard and we had a footy game coming up and I was a bit terrified of running on the field without a mouth guard. So I remember it pretty clearly. It was a stinking hot day, you know, Brisbane summer, and I left school at lunchtime and I wandered down the road to the local dentist to get a new mouth guard.
Yeah.
And stinking hot day, I went in. It was beautifully cool and air conditioned in there, and I went in and it was nice and clean. And he was a really nice bloke, and he took an impression for a mouth guard. And he said, you know, do you want me to check your teeth? I won't charge you anything. And he did that really quickly, did a quick checkup.
Yep.
He said, you got a good set of choppers, out you go. And I went out and I paid $80 for it,
yeah.
Which was, at that time, I'd worked for 16 hours pushing trolleys to local Target in order to pay that $80.
Yeah.
And the next time I went back and got my mouth guard, you know, that was all of 10 minutes work for him. And I said to him, is that your Jaguar out the front? It was a Jaguar sitting out the front, and the number plate read my V12. And he said, yeah, it's nice, isn't it? And I thought, yeah, that sort of stuck in the back of my head as perhaps something that might be worth pursuing,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, the potential rewards.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was pretty much it. And went to uni, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. At that stage, you to do dentistry, you had to do a year of science, and then or pharmacy or something like that, and do particular subjects that then rolled into second year dentistry. So I started off in science, mucked around for a year or two, and eventually decided dentistry would be the go.
Fantastic. And so just coming back to those days of pushing trolleys around Target, was that the only job you had as a kid growing up? Was it that same job throughout, or did you have others as well? Because I had a few shockers when I was a kid.
Well, Target was my first job, and I did that for a couple of years. But then once I turned about 16, about 16 years old, I started working at the Hilton in Brisbane, which is where my mother worked.
Yeah.
My sister was working there as well, so they got me a job in there washing dishes, which was pretty good actually, because you could work sort of longer days, you could work nights as well, and that pretty much went through university as well until I got the Navy scholarship. And actually, I stayed on for a little bit once I got the Navy scholarship, and that was a pretty big part of my youth, I guess, or my young adult years working at the Hilton,
yeah.
Especially before I got the Navy scholarship, because you met a lot of people working there, and a lot of the people there were students. They were in the same boat, and there was this, you know, no one was afraid of hard work. You took whatever hours you could get, and you worked till 2 a.m. Saturday morning, and then you rocked up again at 8 a.m. to start an 8 or a 12 or a 16 hour shift, you know, when the hours are on offer.
Mate, I'm thoroughly jealous of you, because I got knocked back by the Hilton and those crowd. I don't think I met the standard for their employment.
What did you do to get knocked back by the Hilton?
I don't know, but my fall from grace there was profound, because I was then relegated to cotton chipping as a student, which was hard work. So, but anyway, mate, so you worked there throughout, you know, school and then through uni and all the rest until the Navy came along. And what was the impetus to join the Navy? Was it, again, something that you thought, this is a path to, you know, an employment opportunity or path to learn things? Or was it that something you thought, wow, this is a path to adventure and something I really want to do, or all of the above?
I wasn't very good at stepping outside of my comfort zone, and I saw the Navy as a way to force myself to do that.
Yep.
There was a bloke I worked with at the Hilton who was studying engineering, and he was an undergrad with the Navy, so the Navy was sponsoring him through engineering. So that's probably where I first heard of the concept. But primarily, it was just ultimately it was a way to, you know, not have to work so hard during uni. That's what it came down to. And the day that I got my letter, because I applied for the Air Force and the Navy, and I got the Air Force letter of acceptance first. And I got home, and it was a stinking hot Brisbane summer night. And it was 2 a.m. and I'd gone from uni. I was at uni all day, and then I went straight down the Hilton and washed dishes for 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
Drove home, 2 o'clock in the morning, just sweaty and disgusting. And I got that letter saying that we're going to pay you what I could earn at the Hilton for a year, just for turning up to uni. And I thought, that's fantastic. It was a really wonderful thing for me.
Yeah, I had one of those scholarships as well, and I think our motivations were very similar. And like you, it was a wonderful experience and a wonderful respite from, I suppose having those jobs that I think as students, we all, or most of us had a job going through uni. I think most of our year group had a way of supporting themselves and going into the Navy was, you know, a good way of getting a few bucks and you know, being able to focus pretty much on your studies and your social life. Mate, so you joined the Navy in 1999, correct?
Yeah, so that's when I started working with the Navy.
Yep. And how was that?
It was a little bit of a baptism of fire because the first job that I went to, there weren't any other Navy dentists there. So there was a dentist who was very experienced. So from a clinical point of view, he was able to mentor me, but there wasn't anyone there permanently who was a Navy officer to sort of help me work out how to run a department. So I was basically straight into trying to run the department. Some more senior dentists sort of came to Nowra. I was working in Nowra every now and then to help out. But, you know, ultimately, and they were very helpful, but ultimately I was trying to run the place myself. And certainly now when I look back at the way I was doing things, I think I may have been led astray by my senior sailors, by my senior managers a little bit in terms of what was appropriate and what wasn't. And I was probably very easily led astray at that point. But that was interesting for me because the Navy over time puts you on courses and you learn things about leadership and how to manage people, and you know, you work out what works for you and what doesn't. But there's a little bit to be said for just experience and maturity in that as well. Yes. And as a 22 or 23 year old, having to sit down with 45 year olds who were bringing problems to you, and just in my head thinking, why on earth are you coming to me? It just didn't make sense to me, but that's the way it worked. And you know, that I guess to an extent that probably happens with most dentists or young professionals when you graduate and you go out into the workplace and you're automatically put into a position of authority and forced to deal with issues. And often with, you know, that title and that position automatically makes your subordinates see you as someone who, you know, might be able to understand and manage certain situations in a certain way. And without, unless you've got a natural flair for it, without some sort of framework to work with, it can be pretty challenging. But, you know, in terms of being a dentist and a place to go when you graduate, it is a wonderful situation because you, from a clinical point of view, you're usually going to go somewhere where there's a mentor who will look after you. You've got a reasonable amount of control in terms of what you're doing, and you've got patients that will come in and not require you to sell anything to them, or you know, most of the time they're fairly obedient in terms of what you might suggest they require, and they'll comply fairly quickly, and you've generally got pretty good facilities and materials and support available to you. As you move through your career as a dentist, you tend to start to just wish that you had a little bit more control in certain aspects of your professional life in the Navy. But, you know, it's not for everyone, but in terms of ways to start out, I think it's a pretty good, good way to start out.
Cool. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you've just joined us, we're speaking to Dr. Pat Caldwell, endodontist from Brisbane, and we're just recounting some of his Navy days. And, Pat, as you've, you know, gone to HMS Albatross there in Nowra, and you found yourself in charge of the department, you know, basically, welcome to the Navy, here's the deep end, see how you go with that. What sort of situations, I know you said you were you know, trying to guide some older, you know, staff members, 45-year-olds, through whatever challenges they might have been having. Does anything really stick out for you as a memorable, I don't know, bit of a memorable thing you had to deal with?
I don't know if you've ever been in this situation, Jesse, but when you have a group of younger people working together. sometimes
what could possibly go wrong?
Look, sometimes there's personality clashes, and that's what it comes down to most of the time. And you know, I'd occasionally, and they were never really big things, but I'd be listening to the stories and just not really being able to comprehend how this situation could arise or how it could even be a problem. And that's tough sometimes, trying to put yourself in the shoes of the person that has the issue, and the issue always seems far bigger to the person that has the issue,
of course,
and trying to appreciate where they're coming from. You know, that's probably one of those times where you have the experience and the, you know, just the framework to work within helps you out.
Yeah.
You know?
So did you develop your own framework for that, Pat, or was there some sort of mentoring process that gave you a framework in the Navy, or did you just kind of have to sit and think, okay, well, how am I going to create an environment, a framework, a toolbox here to work with so that I can handle these situations? How did you resolve that issue?
Oh, look, I just bumbled along at the time. You know, I certainly had more senior guys around that I could speak to, you know, if I needed to. And, you know, guys like Peter Fatouris up in Sydney, he was always very useful. And Commodore Dowsett came and visited a few times. And, you know, in terms of experiences, there's no one who's more experienced at, you know, working the Navy than he was. You know, so that was pretty helpful. Most of the training in the Navy that I found useful and applicable came much later on in my career.
Yeah.
So they would train you at a time when you were supposed to be looking after subordinates. Yeah. So, you know, that probably wasn't till I'd been in for 5 or 6 years, you know, that you're doing those courses that are specifically aimed at management and leadership skills. I mean, there's certainly some early on, but it wasn't until I did those courses and then I thought, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I can see how this applies and I can see how that, you know, would have been useful or how I could have managed that better at the time.
So do you think those lessons have held you in, you know, good stead? I'm assuming they have, but, you know, at what point did some of those lessons transfer across to, you know, you're in private practice now? Is anything from those early experiences, you know, still with you? What have you taken along the way?
I think one of the big things that I learned was when I was first in that situation of trying to manage the department, I just wanted to do everything myself and I wanted it all done in a particular way. And one of my senior sailors, Andrea Marsh at the time, she sort of came and said to me, look, you're not using me. I can do this stuff. I can manage the department. You know, that's what I'm here for. And I thought about that and then I changed the way I did things there. I started delegating and as I sort of rose through the ranks a little bit and eventually I ended up in Sydney and I was the fleet dental surgeon and I had some really clever men and women working for me up there. And I had one of them, Jacob Smith. He came to me when I was leaving and he said, I really appreciate how you just told me what you wanted me to do and then let me do it. Yeah. And that took me a little while to figure out that was a really great way for some, maybe most people to function. If I just gave them a framework and said, look, we want to achieve this, lots of them would do it ways that I wouldn't have done it. And I would look at, you know, even if they'd written something and I wouldn't have used those words. But I learned to just say, well, it doesn't matter as long as we're going to get achieve the outcome that we want to achieve. So that was something that was probably one of the biggest things I took away, you know, just trying to work out how to get people to do things for me that would achieve a goal. And just seeing some of those people blossom as well when they were given the freedom to achieve things. Probably went a little bit overboard on that sometimes and not giving enough guidance.
So the boundaries were a little too far out in some cases, you think?
A bit too loose, or, you know, expecting people to do things that were unrealistic of them.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't have the skills for. Occasionally I saw that being a bit defeating for them because they just couldn't do it, you know. And probably needed a little bit of a push in the right direction. So that's probably the main thing that I took away. And that was something that, again, came up in those later courses that I recognized.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, actually that makes sense.
But that's a really good skill, isn't it? To be able to, you know, focus on the outcome and say to someone, you know, I'm not here to micromanage you. I have faith in your ability to deliver this. Here's the outcome. Make it happen in any which way, you know, is appropriate, and use your initiative and skills to bring that to bear. I think it's a wonderful lesson that, you know, all of us can probably, you know, take heed from. You mentioned that you were the Fleet Dental Surgeon, and clearly before you became the Fleet Dental Surgeon, you would have had some time at sea. I know, for instance, you spent some time on HMO Success as mm-hmm. the dentist there. And this is as a GP, right? Not as an endodontist at that point in your career?
That's right.
Yeah,
yep.
Cool. So you're on HMO Success, which has a luxury custom-made dental surgery. Compared to, I must tell you, the hard yards that I did lugging damn dental chairs up and down ladder bays and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, you had the luxury life, mate. But where was the... where was the destination that you enjoyed going to most? Where did you sail to, and what was so fun about it?
Well, first, I should point out that I did plenty of lugging of equipment around because I sailed in Canimbla and Menora a bunch of times, Newcastle and Adelaide, and there's fair share of lugging that gear around. So I know where you're coming from, and it was the worst job in the Navy.
Wasn't it amazing how that stuff? The stores guys would just disappear as soon as that dental chair was anywhere near the dock. That just
fair enough.
Yeah, I would too. But anyway, sorry, I digress.
Yeah. So look, I think when I think back about that, the feeling that you had when you were on the bus, so a ship would, you know, you might be at sea for anywhere from a few days to 2 weeks, or I did a 4 week stretch once.
Yeah.
And, you know, those times at sea are really for working, you know, you're there, you can get a lot done. You've got nowhere to go. You know, it's a 20 second walk to work sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what it comes down to. And, by no means am I saying we worked hard compared to some of the other people on the ship. You know, the guys who were keeping the ship running worked more hours than we did, and you know, probably got a lot less sleep than we did. But regardless of that, when you're coming into a port, especially if it was somewhere interesting, like, you know, Phuket or a, you know, Pacific sort of port, if you're coming into Port Vila or something like that, you know, there's a bit of a build up there and people start to get excited. And, you know, when the ship goes to anchor and they bring out some smaller boats that you jump on and you go ashore, and there's a bus waiting to take you into the main part of town, and you're on that bus, that's one of the best feelings in the world. You know, it's pretty fun because you're there with, you know, a couple of hundred people, you know, and a whole bunch of your mates.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you try to compare all those different places, I'd have to say Phuket, you know, places like that were up there because they were just so different.
Yeah.
But we had some amazing times in Australian cities as well, you know, pulling into Darwin or Townsville or Adelaide, you know, just some fantastic times there. And those sorts of fun times, those parties, something that's hard to replicate anywhere, I think, you know, without that really close working environment that you have with your shipmates.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot of fun, and certainly I remember sailing around to a few places as well, and again, having those runs ashore, always as you're coming into harbour, you know, as you rightly point out, that sense of anticipation, excitement goes up quite a lot. I'm curious to know about your dental experiences at sea, because when I first went to sea as a dentist, like, we had no x-rays. I took one tooth out at sea and I took the snapped the crown off it. Yeah. I was first or second year out of uni, and my poor old dental assistant just looked at me as the beads of sweat were running down my forehead.
Sure.
And, which we got it out. And Mick, the dental assistant, goes, Cowhorn's boss? And, thank goodness we got it out. But I'm curious to know whether you had any particular experiences, you know, like that at sea, where you just, you know, they're etched in your memory.
Look, I think, you know, one of the best bits of advice that I got when I went to sea, and so this was from my fleet dental surgeon, who was David Dugan at the time. He told me that what he primarily wanted from me was to do a good PR job for Navy Dental. And he said, you know, do good dentistry, but do a good PR job. And part of that, which, you know, you learn eventually from experiences like the one you had, was not doing anything that could particularly go wrong. You were supposed to be there to help the Navy personnel do their job, not hinder them. And so, you know, you definitely learn those. But I think it's the similar sort of situations that any young dentist would be in through lack of experience, and exactly that situation you're describing, where you break a crown or something like that. I think the things that were the most disconcerting were things like, you do a simple, you know, simple DO restoration, and that person then happens to have a whole lot of post-op pain.
Yeah.
But instead of them going home and complaining to their family, you're sitting at dinner with them and they're complaining to everyone around them. And you're just wanting to shrink and disappear. Try and explain it away as best you can. That's part of the difficulty in terms of treating people that you live and work with, and only treating people that you live and work with.
Yes.
I mean, managing those situations. And definitely, you probably would have experienced this, but on an FFG, when you set up your dental department, it's right down the aft end of the ship.
Yeah, so an FFG, ladies and gentlemen, an FFG is a guided missile frigate, one of the older ships in the Navy, which shows that Pat and I are getting old too. Sorry, mate, just to cut across you there. Sorry, mate, go on down aft battle station, yep.
Yeah, so in a fairly small space, in fact, when you think about it, it's ridiculous, the space that you're in. When you hear the call over 1MC that there's a man overboard drill.
Yeah.
And that's the, I mean, the chairs we used were heavy, right? They were super heavy. And it's the only time I've ever seen one of those chairs with someone in it slide across the deck, because when
the handpiece wasn't in there.
Yeah. For a man overboard drill, you do a U-turn. And those ships really roll, you know, they roll about 45 degrees. That was interesting. But we had pretty good equipment, actually. Yeah. The stuff that came in just as I was going to sea was pretty good. It was basically A-deck equipment, but compacted into some boxes. So the equipment we had was good. We could take x-rays. And after I left, I know Marco Sullivan, who's in the Air Force, did a lot of good work setting up some digital x-ray units. So now they've got handheld x-ray units with digital sensors connected to a laptop. And, you know, I think it's all pretty good stuff. And the work we did was good, you know. Situations could make it challenging sometimes, but the work we did was just as good as anything you'd do ashore. Provided the circumstances around you were okay.
Yeah, look, the lesson I got when I had that incident taking the tooth out in the crown, it was decoronated. I remember thinking that I was basically a new dentist. Like, you went to Albatross very early in your career, and I went to sea very early in my career. And the similarities, of course, are that, largely you're on your own to an extent, and particularly sea. But I remember the lesson that I took away from that was never to be bullied by the patient into performing treatment you're not 100% comfortable with. Thankfully, I had a PA to work from. I just couldn't take an updated one. But I remember vividly going, okay, well, the lesson for me there is that patient came in abject pain. I really should have just taken the pulp out, which, of course, is, you know, your bread and butter these days. But, yeah, I had to learn to stand my ground and step into that role of being the dentist. So I think as a young dentist, I think lots of young dentists kind of struggle with that to some extent. You know, they've got their degree and now it's about, you know, owning that role to an extent.
Yeah, for sure. I think lots of older dentists can still struggle with things like being bullied by patients.
Absolutely,
it's difficult.
Yeah, it is a tricky one. So, mate, I know you went off to do your endo degree in the early 2000s, but before we get to that, what was the weirdest place? Actually, it could be before in the Navy or after Navy. What's the weirdest place you've done endo?
Done endo?
Yeah.
Well, that is... Oh, well, it's got to be on a ship. I don't know if it's weird, but I guess it would be. Yeah, it probably... Look, probably the most interesting was on board the USNS Mercy, which is a US Navy hospital ship. Nice. So maybe about 2007, went on a deployment called Pacific Partnership, and that's led by the US, but a whole lot of different nations get involved. So there were Canadians and Kiwis and a bunch of different defence forces there contributing. And that ship was, it's extraordinary. It's fairly common. It happens, I think, every year. And there's always Army, Navy and Air Force contribution to it. But, I mean, we were on a ship and it had, I think, 4 dental surgeries. It had 2 dental GA surgeries. It had a lab on it. There was a CT machine. There were 1,000 hospital beds and 8 operating theatres. And that was in Dili in East Timor. So anchored there doing that. And that was, I guess... you know, rewarding because it was local Timorese that came in and just wanted to hold on to their teeth if they could. And we were able to provide fairly high level care for them, you know, followed up with a CEREC onlay or crown because there were 3 CEREC machines on board. So, you know, that was pretty interesting.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
cool. And so that's probably, you know, one of the best kitted out dental surgeries you'll ever see with that kind of gear.
At sea, for sure.
Yeah, certainly at sea. Yeah, absolutely. So, mate, you went on to become an endodontist and you did your specialty training back at the University of Queensland, completing it in 2005. Again, what led to endo? What was it about endo that attracted you to it? And you know, how do you kind of see that GP as the GP years as the foundation for that?
Look, I've been asked this a bunch of times, and when I think back, I think that I found endo to just be the skill that I had the most trouble getting my head around. And I thought, you know, I just want to learn to do this properly.
Yeah.
Not that I was, you know, particularly skilled in any, you know, facet of dentistry, and that's probably part of what drove me to wanting to specialize, just the fact that I thought I'm never going to get the hang of all this stuff that we've got to do.
Yeah.
And even now when I see what GPs, general dentists are able to do, the level of skill they have in so many different areas, that it blows me away actually. And I think that GPs have a far more difficult job than specialists have. And occasionally we get really difficult patients to deal with, difficult cases to deal with. But day-to-day stuff, I just don't know how general dentists do it all. And I think that's really what drove me to it. I also really considered pursuing oral maxillofacial surgery. But endodontics was... it was an easier option, really. Just
a shorter one.
It was easier to get into, and yeah, it was shorter. You know, it was only a couple of years ago that I'm seeing guys I went to uni with finally becoming oral maxillofacial surgeons, and
yeah,
I've already been an endodontist for 7 or 8 years at that point. But yeah, I was fortunate in that I'd only I guess I'd only been out of uni for 4 years, so I still knew the people at Uni of Queensland, yeah. and I had a fairly easy time of getting into it, into the degree, so I was pretty lucky at that point. And, yeah, it was just the thing I found the most difficult, and I really wanted to get in and become comfortable with it. And I also liked the biological aspects, you know, I liked the healing aspect of it all, and, you know, helping people to keep their teeth that they might otherwise lose.
Cool. So just coming back to the wanting to master it, I'm just picking up a sense, are you a competitive kind of guy? Like, you give me a task and I'm going to kind of make sure I nail it. Is that you?
Mostly, yeah.
He says with a degree of hesitation, yes. I'll take that as a yes. cool. So, mate, you were still in the Navy at that point, and obviously after you'd finished your training, you went back to the Navy for a period of time and took on, obviously, more and more senior roles. And then you went to China for a while, right?
Yeah, when I finished up with the Navy, I was at a point in my Navy career, and I think a lot of military dentists get to this point where you're looking down the barrel of doing more and more admin and less clinical time. Yeah. And I had, at that time, you know, what I considered to be the best job in the world, and, you know, working in Sydney with a surgery that looked out onto the harbour, and I was getting people telling me that I was doing a wonderful job as the fleet dental surgeon, and nice. I wasn't doing anything. It was, you know, the people, the men and women that I had working for me that were just really doing all the work, and you know, sometimes it's hard to impress on people that they were the ones that were achieving. And they've all gone on to do bigger and better things, and it's great to see where they are these days. But I was just looking for something interesting to do, and I'd always wanted to go and live overseas, and I had some friends that were living in China at the time, and I went and visited, and I thought, yeah, this is interesting. And at the time, it was really the middle, you know, the depths of the financial crisis, yeah. and there weren't a lot of – things are looking pretty bleak in the UK, and, you know, we don't have that many places that we can easily go and work. UK was one of them, but things were looking pretty bleak, and I didn't look like I was going to get a job there, so – I just took off, you know, had a bit of money and a bit of long service leave up my sleeve. So, yeah, I just headed over to China, and it took me a while to get a job there. I sort of settled in Shanghai eventually, and eventually started working for a couple of sort of bigger hospital type clinics there. But it was interesting. There was no real referral culture over there. So, you know, for the Australians listening, for me at the time anyway, it was quite different to the way that I was used to seeing dentistry practiced, and yeah. things would get referred often. And I've since sort of learnt that around the world and in different countries that there isn't necessarily the referral culture that we have in Australia. You know, there's lots of places around the world where dentists just do their dentistry.
Yeah, yeah.
And if something's hard or difficult, they'll try it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And they just get around it, and they learn to do all sorts of things like place implants and do ortho and that sort of thing. So that was interesting at the time. So I wasn't, you know, there was a city with 21 or 22 million people in it.
Yeah,
and
huge.
As far as I was aware, I was the only foreign-trained endodontist working there.
So you're working as a specialist or as a GP?
I started off as a GP. That's how I got the job.
Yeah.
And then about 3 weeks into it, and when I realized I really couldn't do a scale and clean very well anymore, I just sort of went and said, oh, look, I might just do the endo. And they said, okay, and that worked out all right. Yeah,
cool.
But I was still only working a couple of days a week.
Yeah,
there, which was great. You know, had time to travel around, and I started playing rugby and met some really interesting people that were, I mean, by virtue of the fact that those people, mostly expats, were living in Shanghai, and a lot of them, they weren't there with the company. They were there to just make their own way with whatever they they did. So they were really different to people that I had met before, and it was a different lifestyle. You know, I don't often get a call at 9:30 on a Tuesday night saying, let's go out for cocktails in Brisbane.
So anyone listening, if it is a Tuesday night and you're looking for someone to go for cocktails, that's your man.
Well, you'd probably wake me up if you tried to call me.
So it sounds like, just listening to you speak about the people with whom you're interacting in Shanghai, it sounded like a different sort of person, like the ones that were there making their own way. Were they, you know, entrepreneurial sorts of people? Were they there trying to, you know, carve out a path for themselves in that regard, or were they there for other reasons?
Yeah, look, most of them were entrepreneurial in some way, and you know, China was the big thing at that time, and I guess still is to an extent now. But they were people who were just there to, you know, do their own business and try and build something, whether it be providing things to Chinese or whether it be providing things to the rest of the world. And even the ones that were working for bigger companies, often they were a bit entrepreneurial as well. I mean, they'd work to get these overseas postings. And for example, there were a couple of architects that I knew, and they were working in architectural firms, earning really poor wages, really, really not very good at all. And they were doing jobs that they would never, ever do back in their own country.
Yeah.
They were in control of projects that were probably 10, 15 years away for them at home.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though they were not, you know, working for themselves, in terms of their career, they were doing wonderful things.
Yes.
By being there. So, yeah, I mean, that's the sort of, you know, I guess just because there's fewer people around, and when you're living in an expat, you tend to be a bit more open to new people and, you know, new experiences and that sort of thing. So you do tend to, you know, get out and about a little bit more. Cool. Yeah.
So, mate, as you're interacting with those guys, and I know you've had some other business ventures beyond dentistry as well, did some of that entrepreneurial spirit or learnings from China and hanging out with that crowd in Shanghai, as you've come back to Australia, and obviously you've set up Brisbane Microsurgical Endodontics, which, you know, is going really well, you know, did any of those lessons kind of come through and help you with that process?
When you're hanging around with entrepreneurial people, it's a little bit infectious. And, you know, we all love hearing those stories about someone who developed a product and, you know, is sleeping on their you know, programmer's couch to save money and doing contra deals in order to get their website up and running, and then eventually made it big. And, you know, they're all really interesting stories. And, you know, I had, even when I was doing my master's, I had a small business where we were selling electronics on the internet, you know, MP3 players and that sort of thing. And I learned a lot from that in terms of, I guess, just how business on the internet works and just customer service as well, I guess. You know, from that, there were times when we would, you know, something would go wrong and you'd do whatever you could to correct the situation. And they were the people that were by far the most appreciative of what you'd done for them. And, you know, I see that now in dentistry as well. You know, I had a case a couple of weeks ago. I did a refilling for someone. I went back to the dentist, got a crown done. And less than 12 months later, they were back to see me because it wasn't feeling right. And there was a really large defect. It was a lower 7 on the lingual. And I don't know if it was some sort of invasive cervical resorption or whether it was just plain old caries, but it was massive.
Yeah.
And maybe it was there, you know, when we did the root filling and didn't notice. And I just organized for him to see an oral surgeon and have the tooth taken out, and he had a bit of a time issue, so pulled some strings, got the tooth taken out, got the bill sent to me, and that guy wrote to me and his dentist just the loveliest letter about how much he appreciated what we'd done for him. Now, obviously, it's a really bad result, and value for money for him was poor. But there's those, you know, whenever I see something like that not going right, you know, I really accept that part of me doing this job and charging people a lot of money for it is taking on responsibility to some extent for it. You know, those patients definitely have to accept the risk that things might not go well, but and I don't offer guarantees or anything like that. But when someone doesn't get the outcome that they'd like and I'd like for them, I do whatever I can to make it right for them. And that was certainly something I learned, you know, way back then, dealing with people. Also learned that some people can be unreasonable right from the start, no matter what you do.
Yeah.
You'll never be happy, you know, looking for an argument.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just life, I guess, in general.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, there's a thing, what you've touched on is a thing called the recovery paradox. And it's what you've experienced and described there is quite well known in the marketing literature, where we talk a lot about, you know, patients will have or customers will have a certain tolerance for things going well. Going awry, I should say. But it's how you recover from that that really makes or breaks the relationship. And clearly, you know, with that online business, you learned a lot about customer service. And I suspect you probably are of that nature anyway, Pat. You want to make sure that everything is right for people. But that's obviously stood you in really good stead. And now, you know, you're getting letters from these patients who, you know, as you've indicated, have had probably not the ideal clinical outcome, but, you know, you've handled it well and they're still grateful for you taking responsibility and getting it sorted for them. I think it's a wonderful outcome all around. So you've been selling your stuff online for a while and, you know, obviously, you know, that's been a great experience. What did you learn about, you know, internet marketing? Because I know, you know, you and I have had lots of discussions over years. And one of the things that I've always been drawn to during our conversations is that I always felt like I was talking to a kindred spirit, someone who kind of, you know, was interested in that. And I know you've had some really good success with it. So I'm curious to know about what lessons came out of the MP3 business that, you know, you've also borrowed.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that I've had a lot of success out of these other businesses, because certainly in terms of a monetary aspect, probably not wonderful success. And that's, you know, that's just part of it. And to be honest, I enjoyed every second of, you know, doing those other things and, you know, selling the electronics online. You know, I learned that was a difficult business to be in, because there are a lot of people trying to steal stuff from you. You know, it's a lot of credit card fraud, and that's probably what ultimately just made us decide to leave the business alone. You know, I learned things, just things that blew me away, actually, in terms of how the internet was working. And this was sort of early on, you know, in internet sales.
This was
2004, you know, 2005. And so people were really just feeling their way. And, you know, for me, you know, to find out that if you bought something online, the credit card processor would just check that the card number and expiry date were valid and there was money on the card, and they would approve the transaction. And it was up to the retailer to ensure that whoever used that card owned that card. So nothing was checked. The name wasn't checked. The address wasn't checked. Nothing like that. And then the credit card processors would then come back to you if someone had charged back and say, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing sending out these products to fraudulent
people?
So that was interesting. But I mean, at the time, a funny conversation I had, or a funny experience I had with my web programmer, was one where she called me and said, look, I've just been to this conference and I've learned this really powerful technique, and I'm going to try it out on your website. And I'm like, sure, I'll go for it. And so this technique was called search engine optimization.
It
hadn't really been heard of before then.
Yep.
And so our website was on the domain mp4store.com.au.
Yep.
Because at that point, you know, MP3s were big, so yep. iPods are only just coming out, and you know, MP4 players were the next generation of MP3 players. And she did whatever she did. She just did, you know, meta tags or whatever, yep. and we wrote some content and changed some of the words on the website to include MP3 player, MP4 player, yep. Apple iPod, and we just zoomed to the number one position on Google, top of you know, number one search result for a whole bunch of keywords. Wow. It was as simple as that, and stayed there for ages. Just
if only it was that simple.
Yeah, so I mean, that was a time when search engine optimization actually worked, and you didn't have to spend a lot of money for it.
Yeah,
and it was extremely powerful because even then, you know, one click on Google for an MP3 player was a dollar or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So
it was really expensive even back then to compete on Google. And part of that was because Google AdWords was fairly new as well, and people didn't really know how to use them, and people didn't understand that in the bidding process, if you only needed to bid 20 cents for a word, but if you both bid $15, you'd be paying $15.
$15, yeah.
So, you know, there was a lot to learn there as well. And I mean, that was, it's really interesting and it still fascinates me.
Yes.
But, you know, it's over the years, I think it's got more difficult and more difficult to keep up with.
Yeah, but and success has many different facets as well, Pat, because, you know, even though, you know, mp4store.com.au didn't set you up to be the next Ruslan Kogan, but some of those lessons have obviously carried through with you, because I know, you know, even in your practice, you've got, you've got a podcast, The Endospot, which is going, you know, really well. It's got good listenership and, you know, it's really engaging. And you've got a website that's, you know, it's got good content on there and it's really user-friendly. It's great with conversions and all those sorts of things. So it sounds to me like even though, you know, mp4store.com.au wasn't, you know, perhaps the Uber of the 2005s, you know, still was very useful exercise.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And you know, I guess anyone who's a small business owner knows that you've got to wear many hats, haven't you?
And yeah.
Marketing is just one of them. And there's no way around that unless you want to spend a whole lot of money, you know, to get someone in to do it.
Yeah.
You just got to at least be competent.
Yeah, cool. And at least know what questions to ask as well. So I reckon if you've got a basic level of understanding and you do have the cash to, you know, get someone in to help you.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you can ask intelligent questions so you're not going to be done over.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. Mate, so you, after China, you came back to Australia, and you set up your practice.
That's right.
And, you know, you're in South Brisbane there. And so I'm curious to know, like, starting a practice from scratch in any particular, you know, GP or specialty practice, you know, comes with some challenges. Clearly, you know, there's no patients.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, from your perspective, you've got to then develop a referral network and, you know, you've got to probably do a bit of direct to the public marketing as well as nurture a referral base. How's that been? You know, what key things have helped you be successful, not just in terms of your direct marketing, but in developing the relationships with the GPs and other referrers?
Well, when I first came back to Brisbane and set up, I assumed that because I knew a lot of dentists because I was from Brisbane, that I would start getting referrals, and that is just incorrect. It doesn't work like that. You know, every dentist that's working in Brisbane that I knew had been out of uni for 10 years, and they knew how to do endo. You know, a lot of them weren't really referring that much, and they already had people to refer to that they were comfortable with and happy working with. So, you know, any referral you pick up, unless they're brand new to the area, you really got to basically take it from someone else.
Yeah.
So that can be quite difficult. And certainly in my first few months, bearing in mind, I opened just as Brisbane flooded. So it was probably, you know.
So
probably,
it was 2011.
Yeah. I mean, it was probably the worst time in history to open a specialist practice in an already, you know, fairly saturated endodontic market.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. But it took a little while to get going.
Yeah.
And, you know, in hindsight, I probably didn't put as much effort into going out and meeting people as I should have. And my, you know, my top referrers now, people, there's one or two that I knew, but mostly people that I've met under, you know, under different circumstances on courses, things like that. Looking back on it, it's funny. It's hard to work out where some of the referrers come from as well, because all of a sudden you'll just start getting referrals from a particular person, and some of those referrals I've been working with for quite a while, and we may have spoken on the phone, but never actually, you know, talked in person. So that's always good when you can get the opportunity to do that sort of thing. But it really, I mean, in terms of working with GPs, one of the things I did early on was I'd been a little bit active on the internet with, you know, in groups, endodontic sort of groups.
Yeah.
And I sought out people that seemed to be really good at what they did.
Yeah.
And I found that a lot of them were using a particular software called TDO, and I chased that down. There was one other user in Australia at the time. It was a little bit US-centric at that time. And the people I spoke to told me that the software was good, but it was the community that came with it that was by far the most valuable, which sounds a bit ridiculous because it wasn't cheap, but by far the community that comes with it is the most valuable thing about TDO. So that really put me in touch with world-leading endodontists in terms of just skills and thinking as well, and it exposed me to a completely different set of just ways of practice that I hadn't been exposed to before. And you know, TDO hold an annual conference, and I go over there. I've missed one of them, but other than that, I go every year, and they have speakers there that just blow your mind. And you know, now I haven't seen a dental lecturer for a long time that has blown my mind. I've seen guys and their skills are amazing, and what their technical skills are outstanding. But you know, TDO, when they're bringing in different doctors and epidemiologists and researchers that are doing things that may be outside the realm of dentistry, but sort of open your eyes to these concepts that we don't get exposed to as dentists, or we get a little bit blinded to because we're dentists. And that sort of really blew my mind. But TDO, the guys there are really focused on, you know, achieving outcomes and the right outcome for the patient. And when I started to realize this, it sort of changed the way I practice, and it changed what I thought was important in terms of practicing. And, you know, some of the things that I learned to do, like placing cores, placing posts, that sort of thing was a challenge for me. But now that I do it routinely, I can really see the value in it from the patient's point of view, because it just gets done at the time. And I've been in the tooth. I can see exactly what's what and where's where. I'm not having to dig out, you know, temporary filling material or whatever to get in there and find it. But also, I really see the value in terms of it from the referring dentist point of view. And you know, the biggest complaint I've heard from dentists about their endodontist is when they get a tooth back that's not restorable. Yeah. So the patient spent a couple of $1,000 having a root filling done, comes back, you take all the filling out, and it's not restorable.
Yeah.
And that just shouldn't happen with with the way I practice here in Brisbane now. It should come back ready to be restored. And, you know, we put a lot of effort into making sure that the tooth is as easy to restore as possible. And it's funny, a lot of endodontists I've spoken to about this say that their referrers don't want them to restore the teeth because, you know, for whatever reason. And that's just not my experience. I've only ever had good feedback from it. I've got one or two referrers that asked me not to. Yeah. They're mainly prosthodontists, and some of the prosthodontists I work with ask me to do it specifically they appreciate it and they tell me which way to do it, and that's fine. But, you know, that essentially as a specialist and as an endodontist, you have two lots of customers. You have your referrers and you have the patients. Absolutely. And primarily you're there to do the right thing by the patient. But other than that, you're there to do the right thing by your referrers as well. And that builds relationships, you know. I really see it as if we're part of a team and we're here to help each other out. And that's the way I approach it. And, you know, that seems to work really well for me.
Yeah, look, Pat, what you're saying there makes wonderful sense. And, yeah, when I was actually living up in Brisbane and working there, I was one of those people who referred to, and I can attest to the happy day that it is when a tooth comes back with a lovely root filling in there. But not only that, with the post, if necessary, and core ready to go, it just makes, you know, GP's life much easier. One of the things that's really coming up for me as you're talking about this, Pat, is, you know, you're saying that some of the other endodontists, you know, were reporting back that their GPs didn't necessarily want them to, you know, restore the tooth on their behalf, yet that hadn't been your experience. And I guess, you know, just wanted to touch on the notion of having, and this is really useful for general dentists as well, is having an ideal patient, or in your case, an ideal referrer as well as an ideal patient, and being clear about who it is that you serve, and, you know, customizing the experience to those people who actually do appreciate that kind of service. Is that something that resonates with you?
Definitely, and that's, you know, I guess I've probably had the experience of working with one or two referrers where it just wasn't really working out in terms of, you know, our expectations of each other, and that's fine. You know, there's lots of endodontists in Brisbane, and, you know, that we work pretty hard to you know, sort things out so that there is a good relationship both ways. And if it doesn't work out, then it doesn't work out. And I think it's the same thing, you know, for me with patients. There's patients that aren't sort of towing the line in terms of what we require from them. You know, we make that commitment to them when we agree to treat them. We make that commitment, and we're responsible in, you know, in certain ways for their treatment, but they need to, you know, front up and do what they need to do as well. And we don't have any problems telling patients that they probably need to look somewhere else for their treatment as well. Yeah, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. You've really got to, you get the work environment that you want by creating the work environment that you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I really agree with that point, and it just translates across everything. Yeah, if you understand who it is you're looking to serve, what sort of experience you want to create for them, then that's the foundation of any good marketing. It's the foundation of good business practice. It's the foundation of a happy life at work too, which is, you know, one of the most important things. Listen, Pat, I reckon we've covered a lot of ground there, and a couple of themes are really cropping up really consistently throughout your life journey. One is, it seems you've had some really good mentors along the way, which has been great. It seems as well that you've been open to new ideas, and you've explored other ideas, and you've been able to take them, you know, I suppose, cross-industry innovation, which is one of the things that tickles my funny bone a lot. You know, I really enjoy that. And you've taken things from, you know, either the military or your MP4 store, and you've taken that into practice. And the other thing that, you know, knowing you personally, is one of the things that I always think that you do particularly well is you manage to have a good business, a great business, and a really good life as well, which, you know, I think comes back to that last point you just spoke about. So, mate, kudos to you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. And that's something I've been pretty focused on. And, you know, in terms of that work-life balance, there came a point where, you know, I was sort of pushing things as much as I could with work and still taking the opportunities to get away. But I honestly felt like I was being a little bit overwhelmed in terms of the aspects of business. And I was starting to get to the point where I was thinking, gee, it would be nice just to turn up to work and work for someone else. And you spoke about the mentors, and I have had some great mentors along the way, and certainly Navy guys count amongst them, and the TDO guys count amongst them. And I don't know, am I allowed to do a plug for you?
Because
you know, I certainly wouldn't want to hide the fact that I have had you helping me out the last year or so. And oh man, there's so many times where there were just little problems that would come up, and I wouldn't, you know, I'd having you there was awesome to have someone just to toss things around with. But also, you know, and you'd always come up with solutions that I hadn't thought of. And in all honesty, mate, none of it's rocket science, right? But nah. To have someone just explain that to you, someone who's thought about it a lot before and has done these things and discussed the issues with other dentists is just fantastic. But also having someone really and what you did right at the start was reset me right from – go back to basics, strip it back and say, well, what – you know, how do you want to live? How do you want to live your life? And therefore, you're going to need to work this amount or, you know, earn this amount. And therefore, you know, you're going to work this many days or you're going to earn this much per day. How are you going to do that? And that was something that really sort of reinvigorated my appreciation for the practice and has made a significant difference to us as well. So, you know, I should take the opportunity to thank you for that.
Mate, I actually feel a little bit embarrassed because all the work that's been done is you, mate. So, but I appreciate the kind words. Pat, I think we might arrange to meet next Tuesday night at 9:30 for cocktails at your place, mate. Because I know Tuesday night's your cocktail night. Pat, thanks so much for coming onto the show. You've been a wonderfully generous guest and sharing your experience with us and those little insights. And one of the things that, you know, as I'm been listening to your story, because we've known each other for a long time now, but there's lots of little things that I just didn't know there. And I can see now how they've shaped your life, your story, and all the little lessons that come out of that and that you've taken into your practice. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, is really interesting. It's why, you know, when I see people creating a practice that's so, I suppose, reflective of the person driving it. It's really interesting to see and it's rewarding. So, mate, well done to you. That's tops.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I've had a really good time. I've enjoyed it. It's very interesting to be on the other end of the interview. I was thinking about it this morning, and when you're interviewing someone, there's certain things you want them to open up on, and what I found in all my EndoSpot podcasts is that the interviewee, it sometimes feels like they're trying to avoid the controversial stuff and get the right message across. And I can understand where they're coming from.
So we haven't even touched on sex, politics and religion, mate. So we've done all right. That's great.
So I appreciate the opportunity.
It's good fun, mate. Look, thanks for coming on the show. And for those people that do want to go and listen to your podcast, the EndoSpot, mate, the web address is...
Endospot.com is a good way to get there, and there's links to iTunes so you can subscribe and download it, or you can just listen to it on the web.
Fabulous, mate. Well, I'll be tuning into your next episode and looking forward to catching up soon, mate.
All right. Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/podcast. And to discover how you can go large with your practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.